Show. Head On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Well, looky here, it is Friday on the front porch. This is the Horn. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com is our little old country home. That's where you can go to find the Listen Live button. Of course, we are available on a wide variety of streaming platforms, places like TuneIn Radio, Stitcher Internet Radio app, a number of other places, Roku devices, Streama.com, Dar.fm, all of which are probably being listened to by the National Security Administration. You thought we were joking about Agent Fred, didn't you? No, you didn't. No, you didn't. The podcast address is at whiterosesociety.org, Agent Fred, under the subdomain for this program. And, of course, you can also get the podcast at iTunes. Hi, I'm Bob Kincaid. And this here is what we like to call Friday on the Front Porch. A little chance to relax and kick our feet back after a busy week. And well, it has been a busy week here in Washington, D.C., because that's where I still am with part of the Familia Kincaid. Hi, Agnes, back home in the studio. Hi, love you, miss you. See me waving? Yeah. This has been a busy week, and next week is likely to be even more so. I hope there won't be any interruptions in the program, but the dance card is filling up quickly. We'll be here all week next week and heading for home at the week's end. Why? Well, because we're here working on the Appalachian Communities Health Emergency Campaign, which centers on the passage of the Appalachian Communities Health Emergency Act. See how that works? Yeah. Now, you're playing a big part in the AIC Act and in getting this legislation moving. Just about every meeting that I have gotten in the next week have something to do with work that you have done and will continue to do. Because, well, let's put it this way. Do you live in Vermont? Gosh, it sure would be nice if maybe sometime between, say, now and Tuesday, you might drop a line to Representative Peter Welch. He's your congressman, you know. And tell him that you sure would appreciate it if he would get busy and sign on as a co-sponsor to H.R. 526, the Appalachian Communities Health Emergency Act, the AIC Act. Because after all, those mountains, Those mountains that are largely intact in Vermont, well, those are the Appalachians, too. Vermont just happens to be very fortunate not to have any godforsaken coal under them. But your fellow Appalachians down in places like West Virginia and western, southwestern Virginia and eastern Kentucky and northeast Tennessee, well, we've got coal under our Appalachians, and we're paying with our lives for it. We're paying. They're not paying us. They just give us cancer and take the coal and ship it to India or Russia or China or God knows where. And leave us to our fates. Just say it. So, if you're listening to this program and you're in Vermont, drop Representative Welch a very polite line telling him that you really, really do care what happens in central Appalachia and that, well, those folks down there in West Virginia and southwest Virginia and northeast Tennessee and eastern Kentucky, we're Americans too, and you sure would take kindly to it and remember him in the next election if he would sign on to the AIC Act. And hey, do you live in Massachusetts? I know a lot of you do. If you happen to live in the 7th Congressional District in Massachusetts, you might drop a line to Representative Mike Capuano and tell him something along the same lines, that you really do care about your fellow Americans, and it matters to you when your fellow Americans are randomly and routinely and willfully poisoned and blasted, and that you want him, Mike Capuano, to sign on to the AIC Act, H.R. 526. That's H.R. 526. If you have any questions about it, you can A, write to me at bobkincaid@gmail.com, B-O-B-K-I-N-C-A-I-D, @gmail.com, or B, you can go to aikact.org, aikect.org, and just about everything you could ever possibly want to know about why the AIC Act is an absolute necessity is right there, one-stop shopping, as it were. Do you live in Washington State? Do you live in the district represented by Dave Reichert, R-E-I-C-H-E-R-T? Well, it sure would be nice if you do, if you could drop him a line and tell him that it matters whether or not little babies are born with birth defects brought on by mountaintop removal, and that you do care about the unborn Americans in Appalachia, and that you sure would appreciate him signing on to the AIC Act. Do you live in Washington State in the district represented by a fine fella by the name of Derek Kilmer, K-I-L-M-E-R? Well, if you do, it sure would be helpful if you would drop a note to him and tell him that, yes, Appalachia matters, even though it's a long, long, long way away from Washington State, and that you need him to stand up for people who have no voice and no representation and sign on to the AIC Act, H.R. 526. Do you live in Minnesota? You could drop a line to Al Franken and tell him you want to see the AIC Act introduced in the United States Senate. Because, of course, it hasn't been introduced there. Tell him that poisoning hillbillies is not something that anybody who professes to care about human rights should turn a blind eye toward. If you live in Tennessee, you could drop a note and say the same thing to Senators Corker and Alexander. Do you live in the Milwaukee area? How about a note to Gwen Moore? Do you live in western Wisconsin? How about a note to Ron Kind? Do you live in New York State? How about a note to Senator Kirsten Gillibrand. In Washington State, how about a note to Senator Maria Cantwell? You live in Colorado. How about a note to Colorado? Do you how about a note to Senator Udall? Massachusetts? Yeah, we could use notes to Senator Warren. Hey, down Florida way, how about a note to Alan Grayson? He's a good, good progressive. He needs to be on this bill. H.R. 526. Up in Michigan, we sure would appreciate the support of Senator Debbie Stabenow in getting this bill moving over in the Senate. We've got to have it in both houses. It's not in the Senate right now. We've got to have a hero. We've got to have somebody that's willing to speak up for people who have been rendered voiceless by their own senators. You live in Alabama? How about a note to Representative Terry Sewell, S-E-W-E-L-L? She could be a big help in this. And that's just a few. That's just a few of the folks that we've been contacting over the course of this week, and hopefully we'll be talking to them or members of their staff in the coming week. Hey, upstate New York, how about Richard Hanna? He's a Republican, but he's also a moderate Republican, as is Dave Reichert in Washington State. If you're in his district, you might follow the lead of Dr. John, who's already made contact with Representative Hanna's office in Washington State. You might follow the lead of our dear friend, our dear sister Jude, who has been contacting Representative Kilmer's office. If you live in western Wisconsin, you might follow the lead of our buddy Bruce, who's been talking to Representative Kind. You see how it works. This can be done. But this is grassroots stuff. This is not something that some big green is pushing. This is a matter of human rights and human life and real urgency brought on by the people who are being affected by it. And you, our allies, who are key to this process. Thank you. Thank you very much. Okay, Randy. This is the horn Friday on the front porch for Friday, the 7th day of June, 2013. If you're getting the show, I need to know, because I just had a interesting little note from the boss back at the home studio at the mansion in West Virginia. Saying that the show is periodically being burped into by classical music. And by classical music, I don't know if she means Waiting for the Bus or Jesus Just Left Chicago. Shouldn't be happening either way. Is it happening to you guys in the chat room? Let me know, please. Okay. Now, what the... Okay, I'm not seeing anything through the chat room. Okay, so Sergi and Horst, no burping. Good. Let me communicate that back to the boss. Strange indeed. Did you break the internet again, Agnes? Oh, okay. She restarted. Anyway, so that's what's going on here. And, of course, I would be remiss if I did not mention many, many thanks for all of you who stepped up to help last night and helped catch us up and keep us from digging ourselves into a deeper hole than we were already in, having the hole in April and a hole in May and working on a hole in June. If we can raise around $300 this evening, that's 30 folks at 10 bucks, 10 folks at 30 bucks, 2 folks at 150, 3 at 100, 6 at 50. Oh, Jesus, don't make me do all the math. But, if you can help out, it'll keep us, we'll be 300, if we could raise $300 this evening, we'd pretty much have the April and May holes filled in and be pretty much close to on track for the month of June. And you know what, Agent Fred, you, your buddies, why don't y'all kick in too? You're enjoying the show. You're enjoying the program. Don't hide your light under a bushel, Agent. Throw in some dough. We're not here for your amusement. I've been thinking about this story all day long, and it's kind of like the phone phishing story yesterday. Is anybody surprised? I mean, really, honest to God, anybody, is anybody surprised that the United States government is spying on its own people? Because, see, I read the newspaper account via the New York Times, America's paper of record. I'll send them a bill for that. And there's some real, and I know those are real live, honest to goodness, for-profit media journalists and everything, but there's some real parsable language in there about how the United States only did its spying out of the country. Well, you'd kind of like for that to mean that they were only spying on people out of the country. But I don't know about you, but it's not how I read it. It meant that they were going through, well, you know. And I love the press release from Google. Oh, no, we didn't. Oh, yes, you did. Well, people are all the time saying Google's got a back door that the government can get through. We don't. And what that means is, no, they don't have a back door the government could get through. They've got a front door that's wide open with a bouquet of roses sitting in the vestibule in the hallway marked Agent Fred. And frankly, President, not sure. Your explanation of these two programs was not your finest hour. You can't have 100% security and then also have 100% privacy and zero inconvenience, Mr. Obama said, repeatedly stressing that the lawmakers from both parties and federal judges were aware of the efforts. You know, we're going to have to make some choices as a society. You didn't feel that way back when you were candidate, Obama, now did you? No, you felt like the domestic spying program was an odious infringement upon the privacy rights of the American people. That all changed when you started cashing the checks, didn't it? See, I'm not one of these people who's going to sit here and form fit the aluminum foil around my head or anything. I recognize that we live in a goddamned empire, okay? And this is imperial behavior, because the essence of imperial behavior is fascist behavior. Benito Mussolini didn't wake up one morning and just invent fascism. He was relying on history and on precedent I guess this is the point in the program where we remind ourselves that the word fascism is derived from the fasces, F-A-S-C-E-S, the bundle of rods that had an axe in the middle of it that was the symbol of political power in ancient Rome. Oh, Jesus, there he goes talking about ancient Rome again. Are the Young Turks talking about anything? Is Shannon Moore even interesting to anybody? Not ancient Rome, please. Sorry. Powerful Roman political figures were surrounded by thugs who carried a bundle of rods and axes, which they could then use to beat the snot out of anybody who got too close to the powerful. Benito Mussolini called his program fascism not because it was something new, but because it was a return, he thought, to the brutality of the past. And so, imperial power has always had laying in it, whether dormant or in full flower, the seeds of autocratic, authoritarian, dictatorial behaviors. This is that. Sure it is. Granted, President Not Sure wanted to try to play that down. If the intelligence community actually wants to listen to a telephone call, they have to go back to a federal judge. And the federal judge is who? We don't necessarily know. And he hears the evidence in front of what public forum? Oh, it's not. So it all boils down to a case of trust us. Ew. Just ew. Thanks, Fritz. Fritz noting Horn Audio stream working fine. Thank you, Dr. John. No burps or hiccups here, streaming through TuneIn Radio. Appreciate it. Dr. John also noted, and then there's a fast case on the U.S. dime. Oh, my God. Alex Jones is right. Illuminati, Bilderbergers, Aged Agenda 21. Oh! Yeah. Yes, Marty, jokes about me palling around with ginger congressional aides would be considerably inappropriate. Yeah, see, that's troubling, too, Sandra. Sandra just tweeted to me, Obama acts like the citizenry had a choice about the surveillance. You know, that quote. You know, we're going to have to make some choices as a society. I didn't make the choice. Did you get to make the choice? Or are we to understand that we made the choice when we went and voted for the various and sundry Republicans and Democrats who went, ho-hum, yeah, okay, we're going to spy, no big deal. And Senator Aunt Pity Pat in South Carolina said, well, I feel much better when they're spying on me. It makes me all tingly. I kind of like it. I think this is the part where we would ordinarily play the Divinals and I Touch Myself as a bumper. Yeah, Sandra's right. It's all okay because Daddy will protect you. Jeebus. And the goddess of irony has struck again, for those who are keeping score at home. The name of the internet spying program, PRISM, P-R-I-S-M. Thanks for nothing. I'm sure Dr. Bill read that earlier today and thought, really, really? Our little attempt to teach American history via primary sources has been corrupted and co-opted by domestic spying. Oh yeah, no. I mean, go and offer a burnt offering at the altar of the goddess of irony over this one. There are two PRISM programs in the United States. One is an attempt to understand the origins of our allegedly constitutional form of government, and the other is a program to subvert the allegedly constitutional form of government by spying on citizens. That's just rich. I couldn't turn that into a television docudrama on Lifetime or Oxygen or Ozzy Ozium or whatever network and get away with that. Hey, thanks, Rob. Rob got it. You're getting us started this evening in the fundraising. Thank you very much. He just says thanks for the show. Thank you for helping to keep the program going, Rob. It is much appreciated. What you've got is two programs that were originally authorized by Congress have been repeatedly authorized by Congress. Bipartisan majorities have approved them. Congress is continually briefed on how these are conducted. There are a whole range of safeguards involved, and federal judges are overseeing the entire program throughout. Again, translation, trust us, rubes. And then I love this line especially. If, in fact, there were abuses taking place, then presumably those members of Congress could raise those issues. They are empowered to do so. See, there's that magic word in the middle of all of that. Presumably. Presumably. Oh, yeah, this is a, you know how we all love bipartisanship, right? Yeah, this is one of those bipartisan problems because you had Republicans and Democrats standing around wetting themselves and squealing, but what if Osama bin Laden gets us, or Obama wants to send us to FEMA re-education camps? I mean, we need to reauthorize this as soon as possible. What, like water from the toilet? No, the dingo got me civil rights. Jesus. And then there's this. If people can't trust not only... Okay, see, we've got some language problems here. President, not sure. If people can't trust not only the executive branch, but also don't trust Congress and don't trust federal judges to make sure that we're abiding by the Constitution, due process, and rule of law, then we're going to have some problems here. Oh, that's a real F me running moment, isn't it? Can we talk about... I'm sorry, I left him back in West Virginia, but this might be a nice moment to have Dr. Freud handy. Did some speechwriter write this down? If he did, President, not sure. I'd fire him, like yesterday. If people can't trust not only the executive branch, so what President Not Sure has admitted right there is that he is under the impression that people do not trust the executive branch. Way to argue from a position of strength, Barack. Yeah, really, this whole domestic spying thing and the telephone thing, because I don't give a good goddamn about the IRS thing or Benghazi. No. But this stuff, this reminds me of back in the day when we used to argue that he really, really needed a cabinet-level secretary whose secretary was whose name was the Secretary of Jesus, Barack. This again from Sandra. Plato warns of the people's protector who, once having tasted blood, turns into a wolf. and a tyrant.
And that can describe the entirety of government. Now, I guess if you're Fat Tony Scalia or one of those constitutional originalists, what, as Carl Malden used to say in the American Express Traveler's Check ads, what will you do? What will you do? Do you think Thomas Jefferson would have been okay with you know, a peephole drilled into the back of, say, because he didn't like him very well, John Marshall's bedroom, or some way of just catching the carryings on at his cousin Randolph's digs? You're goddamn right he would have. You think Jimmy Madison, little Jimmy, you know, he's not like a hobbit, a little tiny fella. You think little Jimmy Madison would have been okay with it? I bet they would have. See, that's one nice thing that the real PRISM program, not this phony baloney spy versus spy data mining, let's see what kind of porn the world is looking at program. No, that's one thing I've learned with the real PRISM program. The folks who started this, who founded this nation, founded it of themselves, for themselves, and yeah, baby, by themselves. Speaking on the two spying programs, my assessment and my team's assessment was that they help us prevent terrorist attacks. I'll be damned. I didn't know there was a terrorist attack prevention exception to the Bill of Effing Rights. Did you? Mm-mm. So, yeah, again, translation, trust us. But from the Freudian standpoint, I think it's hard not to note that basically President Not Sure admitted where a whole lot of the country is with regard to government. Now, I'm the one who sits here night after night and talks about how it is government, of we the people, that we're in charge. We're supposed to be running the show. But you know what? We're not. And we're not, because we largely abdicated. We abdicated to go watch Howard Stern give the gong to a guy who was levitating. I mean, don't make any mistakes. You haven't mistakenly tuned into the Fire Dog Lake Radio Hour or Glenn Greenwald dancing on a pinhead. But this is deeply frustrating. I will go so far as to say it is infuriating. Because and what's infuriating about it is that once again, this administration is trotting out the same old tired bullshit that the Bush administration trotted out. Because what are they saying? That they're doing this to keep us safe? Shall we go back and review the presidential oath of office? I know right-wingers love to do that all the time. They practically had it memorized during the Clinton administration when they were so unutterably fascinated with Bill Clinton's penis. But this business of, where is it? Yeah. If people can't trust not only the executive branch, but also don't trust Congress and don't trust federal judges to make sure that we're abiding by the Constitution, due process, and rule of law, then we're going to have some problems here. Well, what are the problems we're going to have? Because if we're not trying to figure out what the problems are, that's just a throwaway. That's just a piece of throwaway verbiage. There's all kinds of subtext here for people who are, or for many years, have been engaged in the art of word knowing. If, in fact, there were abuses taking place, then presumably those members of Congress could raise those issues. They are empowered to do so. Is President not sure, saying that his administration is not empowered to try to curtail abuses? Are we being told that if the Obama administration found abuses of these two spying programs, that they would not raise those issues? And what the hell does raise those issues mean? How about, instead of raise those issues, correct those problems or jail those people? They are empowered to do so. Okay, they're empowered. Being empowered doesn't mean that you're willing. And there's probably an entire major's worth of philosophical semantic discussion about what empowered to do so means versus willing to do so. You remember when Jimmy Carter gave that speech in which he never used the word malaise, but which came to be known as Jimmy Carter's malaise speech? Well, this just might be the most memorable thing that Barack Obama has ever said. Never mind all the glowing rhetoric or all the high-toned exhortations. This is the retail presidency of Barack Obama. If people can't trust not only the executive branch, but also don't trust Congress, so thereby he admits that a whole lot of people don't trust him. And, okay, so there's a lot of people who don't trust Congress. I'm one of those, at least the leadership of the House of Representatives, you know. And over on the Senate side, I don't feel real good about Dianne Feinstein. Oh, it's fine. It's just lovely. And don't trust federal judges to make sure that we're abiding by the Constitution? No, until I know that what the suits are and what's going on, I don't trust anything the government wants to do in the dark. This statement is like some English king saying, well, you certainly must trust us to use the Court of Star Chamber in a prudent fashion. Off with their heads. Trust is not hereditary. Trust is not endemic. Trust is earned. What has any single member, whomever they may be, of the Federal Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act Court ever done to earn our trust? Hell, we don't even know if they've done anything to earn their money. They just cash the check. So no, I don't trust federal judges to make sure we're abiding by the Constitution, because a whole bunch of federal judges don't even understand what the Constitution is. C, E.G., C.F., Tony Scalia. But when it gets right down to it, what was under his skin was the leakage. Because this program had become so odious and nasty that somebody with some significant access to data turned over the little PowerPoint presentation. You know, the one that named names like Google and Skype. Right? And President Not Sure said, if, in fact, this information ends up just being dumped out willy-nilly without regard to risks to the program, risks to the people involved, in some cases on other leaks, risks to personnel in very dangerous situations, then it's very hard for us to be as effective in protecting the American people. And there we are with protecting the American people again, that tired old canard. Because, you know, Osama bin Laden's cousin's gonna eat your baby. Protect the American people. Protect the American people. Protect the American people. No, goddammit, Barry. Protect and defend the Constitution of the United States. Because see, if we can protect and preserve and defend the Constitution of the United States, the people of the United States will pretty much take care of themselves. But this place is really no fit place to live if the Constitution is gone. Is the country in a hissy yet? Because how are the hardcore Obama supporters out there? What are the excuses being tendered? Because I have to, if I'm going to maintain anything resembling credibility, I have to note that we would have been standing on our heads screaming. And some of us were when it was George W. Bush. So why aren't we doing it? You know, when it's Obama. And we knew. God damn it, we knew, didn't we? We knew. This is just confirmation of what we knew. I cannot tell you the number of emails I get that have disclaimers on the bottom about government agents reading emails. And how the interweb tubes are not secure. It's too damn much. Oh, by the way, and thank you, Lula. Thank you. Lula's joined in with Rob to help us get the fundraising taken care of this evening. Thank you very, very much. There's no such thing as a small amount, Lula. It does help keep all this on the air. And it is deeply appreciated. From Darlene. Subject line, huh? President Not Sure? For sure. This is in direct contradiction to what Obama said during a webinar Skype-like question and answer session he held a few months ago. One of the young women selected to participate asked him about the drone program and expressed concern about Americans being targeted. President Not Sure had some sort of lame response, but what stood out in my memory is that he indicated that she should not trust him or the government on such issues and that questioning leaders was important to do. Oh, that's vomit-inducing. From Sandra, oh, Bob, Claudius had England. Give Obama a break. Jesus. Yeah, I reckon. Kevin writing from Colorado Springs. Subject line, no choice. Do we really have any choice? I just got home because of the wonderful disabled transportation in our city, which seems to believe they're here to be served instead of serving the disabled. One of the things I get especially upset about is that it could be much better if people would get together and protest and take action in the form of something more than a petition. But not many do, because not many disabled or not actually believe that taking action in mass numbers makes a difference, which it would if you could get the mass numbers. So ultimately, while there may be some, like you or me, that want to see change, not enough of us are willing to make the sacrifice or even get up off the couch to take any action, which is exactly why nothing changes. Make sense? Yeah, sadly it does, Kevin. Who reminds us all, remember, Bob, he's just playing a big old chess game and he's really outfoxing the neocons. We just haven't seen it yet. Continue to believe, sooner or later, you'll see that he really is wanting to protect the American people and the Constitution. Yeah, sure. Ron writes in from Raleigh, hey, Bob, the Bill of Rights should be changed to the Bill of Right, because there is only one right that seems to be of interest to a great many folks, and that's the Second Amendment. Well, remember last night in Looney Louie Gohmert? Freedom of the press contained in the Second Amendment. It's the only amendment he knows is there. And somebody gave that goober Gomer a law degree. I'd love to see him start trying to unpack the rule against perpetuities. Damn, that! I'd sell tickets or buy one. Yeah. The Bill of Rights should be changed to the Bill of Right. Because there's only one right that seems to be of interest to a great many folks, and that's the Second Amendment. SCOTUS has been wiping their collective behinds with the Fourth Amendment for years. This is true. You do not have the right to be secure in your papers, effects, etc., if the police, national security apparatus can sneak and peek your personal effects. The Fourth Amendment is moot. No, Ron, the Fourth Amendment is dead. And this from Dr. John, which I think is really quite telling. Oh, yes, Texas Betsy. They drew Looney Louie's district to be forever red. Oh, yes. But Dr. John asks questions that are well worth the asking. Under the subject line, protecting the American people, Dr. John asks, did this program stop the Boston bombing or the Newtown shooting? Or does it protect my friends in Pennsylvania whose wells are undrinkable because of fracking? Is it protecting your family from the next MTR blast? Can we for once set some damn priorities in this country? Sadly, John, I think we already have. Priority one is... oh, God, you know what? Priority one is spying on people. It really is. Rob wrote in a little bit ago and said, NSA data mining, I feel so relieved that Big Brother is watching and we are all safe. Remember, that's the way fascism works. Fascism works for everybody if you just keep your head down, watch the TV, listen to the radio, immerse yourself in meaningless pop culture drivel, be a consumer, consume, consume, consume. And don't get out there and play in politics or talk about your effing rights, because you know what? Due process is the process you are due. due process is whatever they choose to do. Fascism works because people generally like to keep their heads down. And, of course, the authoritarians are out there. One of the reasons, my God, this is a tough one for the right wing. I mean, I don't want to go out there and get all 11-dimensional chess or anything. But this is a tough one for the right wing because they like this. They loved it when Bush was doing it. They verge, they veer, they're inclined toward the authoritarian. They love this stuff. It's mother's milk to them. This is the authoritarian fascist state that they want. That's why they were so damned quiet about it when Bush was doing it. They like it. And if only it was something, can't we get America to pay attention to the IRS thing or Benghazi or the AP phone thing? Because otherwise the impeachment papers would have been filed before the day was out today. Texas Betsy pointing out the true goal of our miseducation system is to teach us to keep our heads down. And that is the damn truth. Oh, my sincere apologies, Luda. I mispronounced your name, and I hate doing that. I'm so very sorry, and I will not make the mistake again. Randy, responding to Dr. John's note, says, we can't set priorities because we have no perspective. At least the lamestream media has no perspective on the news. That's why Ted Koppel got dumped on the old Nightline series on ABC. He gave his audience perspective. But let's go back to what Dr. John said for a minute. Can we for once set some damn priorities in this country? And I guess what we have to get down with is the fact that we have. These are our priorities. Paranoia is an inherent trait of authoritarianism, just like what? Me being prone to sunburn is a trait of my Northern European melanin-free heritage. It's there. It's always there. Now, I can avoid sunburn by putting on sunscreen or maybe staying out of intense direct sunlight. And we can avoid fascism by not being an empire. We can avoid the worst excesses of authoritarianism by constantly guarding what passes for our republican form of government. But we're a tiny little group, and even when you think about the entirety of the progressive movement in this country or the conservative movement in this country, there ain't that many of us. Like I said the other night, I don't care if you're Rachel Maddow or Chris Hayes or Bill O'Reilly or that life support system for a haircut, Hannity. I don't care who you are. At any given time of any given day, you are getting your ass handed to you by SpongeBob SquarePants. You just are. I'd like to set some priorities in this country. That's kind of why I'm up here. It's why my colleague, my brother Bo, is up here. We're trying to get people to focus on things that matter, like, you know, not poisoning people just because you can. But that's part of the mindset. It's part of the absence of priorities, or at least the absence of the right priorities. We'll poison people for profits. We'll poison babies in the womb for a profit. And you know what else we'll do? We'll spy on people because our paranoia demands it. Because we have to come to grips. We have to come to an understanding that this nation is, I mean, sweet Jesus, paranoid. bad paranoid. Crippling paranoid. And this town more so than just about any other place I've ever seen. The gates go up, the gates go down, the blast gates go down, the blast gates slam back up into place. You can't swing a dust mop in this town without it brushing a member of law enforcement. And that's because this place is hopelessly paranoid. Right? And other places, too. You know, one of these days, people really are going to start going through airports in Speedos and the women in bikinis. Because our paranoia extends that far, too. There's nothing about which we are not paranoid. There's paranoid, and then there's paranoid. And you know what? On a night like this, we are rather in desperate need of a giggle, aren't we? Because I got us one. Oh, yes, I do. It's time, I think. I mean, we've had a lot of fun with the Becker head over the years, haven't we? And no, I'm not going to say I'm never going to play anything he does again, but I want to draw the distinction about legitimate concerns about regarding the future of this nation and the civil liberties which we hold so dearly. I want to juxtapose that against this. Now you know the story. I was gone Wednesday night, so we didn't really talk about it. You know the story about Michelle Obama refusing to engage with that heckler. And say about it what you will, like it, don't like it. You know, I understand why the woman did it. I don't know whether it was effective or not, but I guess it's not really my place to make that determination. I also understand why Michelle Obama simply refused to play. So, okay, I understand both sides. Well, that just doesn't count in the world of the Beckerhead. Now, we're talking about a legitimate assault on the civil liberties of the United of the people of the United States. Nobody is listening into your phone calls. Okay, great. Not now, they're not. But you've damn sure got a log of all of them, and if you've got a log, they're probably recorded too. Because it's not like there have to be bank upon bank upon bank upon bank upon bank of 15-inch diameter quarter-inch reel-to-reel recorders going, this is the digital era, baby, and the Uniblab 10,000 down there in the blast-bunkered bowels of the NSA, it can record a lot of calls. But the funny thing is, with this data mining bullshit, apparently the guy just walks in and plugs his little gizmo into the gizmo, and it's done. Remember a few years ago when there was a lawsuit against one of the major telecoms because somebody said, you know, I saw the place where they put all this stuff in. They just, it was in a closet. It was just in a phone closet, and they installed all this stuff that they could use to spy on the calls, and the phone company let them. And you recall the outcome of that? Yeah, national security exception, wasn't it? Thought so. By the way, have we scheduled Rand Paul's, libertarian ophthalmologist Rand Paul's phony filibuster on this yet? Have the Code Pink folks gotten their Ferrero Rocher chocolate balls ready and their roses so that if Rand Paul finds it and he says, our liberties, and then they can talk about how his testicles are large, and has that happened yet? Anyway, back to paranoia and the Beckerhead.
Immediately she snaps and she walks away. And she says, here's one thing I don't do well. And then she walks away from the microphone to pretty much to confront the person, you know, just like, bring it on. And she says, you can barely hear her, you either talk and I leave or I talk. You want the microphone? And then they shut that person up. And then she walks back, and then she goes right back into the speech. No little funny thing about, you know, hey,
oh, that's,
she just went right back into the speech. So this woman's
enraged.
A monster. She is Lady Macbeth.
Funny thing.
You got that? Now, while you and I are trying to have a relatively meaningful conversation about what the status is of our civil liberties, the Beckerhead has just declared that Michelle Obama is Lady Macbeth. You know, walking around, rubbing her hands together, looking down periodically because she's gone mad as a freaking hatter, going out, damn it, Spot. I didn't know the Macbeth's dog name was Spot, but yeah. Sadly, it didn't end there.
She is a frightening woman.
Gosh.
And I'll tell you something else. I really, truly believe that she, Valerie Jarrett, and Michelle, and Mrs. Eric Holder, that's where the information is going. The wives are talking.
You got that? The whole data mining, domestic spying thing is for the benefit of Michelle Obama, Eric Holder's wife, and Valerie Jarrett. Really? He wasn't kidding. There were no clown horns. There was nothing beeping in the background. That Michelle Obama, she has some special powers because she was able to get George Bush to put those domestic spying programs in place just so they'd be ready when she and her husband, the Kenyan Muslim socialist with the extreme hate, the deep-seated hatred of white people and a rejection of colonialism, took office. My God. Oh, man. Klaatu Barada Nikto. I mean, there's paranoia and there's paranoia. Yeah, Darlene pointing out, today, Miss Lindsey just loves Obama. Oh, yeah, Lindsey Graham is loving this, Darlene says. He said that he is a Verizon customer, after all, and has nothing to hide. Don't tease us, Lindsey. So why not eavesdrop on everyone's calls? Darlene notes, so much for small government, so much for getting government off our backs, so much for the most terrifying words in the English language are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help. Oh, yeah, so much for all that, so much for the Constitution, Darlene. It's Friday. Can I have... God. Okay, so here's how it works. I'm going to take a break. Got to have one. If you're on hold, please stay that way. And we'll come to you out of the break. Here endeth the filibobster. It's Friday on the front porch on the horn. I'm Bob Kincaid. PayPal buttons at headonradionetwork.com. We sure could use your help. And we're about $280 away from where we need to be. Thanks, everybody. We'll be back.
Masses, evil minds that plot destruction, sorcerers.
death's construction. In the fields of bodies burning, as the war machine keeps turning. Death and hatred to mankind, poisoning their brainwashed minds. Oh, Lord, yeah. World stops turning, ashes where the body's burning. No more war pigs have the power, and as God has struck the hour.
It's your second hour in the Liberal Sandbox, and you're head-on with Bob Kincaid.
Welcome back. 7:14 here on the East Coast. Friday on the front porch on the Horn. And we will go straight away to the Skype lines, where I think Sandra is with us. Hey, Sandra. Hey, there you are.
Yeah, no kidding. Let me pot. It's absolutely. Well, I mean, and say, you know, they say they didn't. You know, they're not listening in on the conversation, Sandra. But do I believe that for a minute? Well, look, if you're gathering the metadata, you're gathering the data, aren't you? No, I didn't. I didn't vote for it. Well, precisely. Give me just a second here, Sandra. Let me tinker with a thing here on Skype. Something is misbehaving. Just one sec. Okay. Are you no? Do I still have you? Talk to me again. Dadgummit. This is squirrely. But I get. You know, I always wonder what's going to go sideways in any given one of these evenings, because something always goes wrong. And in this case, apparently, Skype has failed me. So my sincere apologies, Sandra. I hear you and you hear me, but apparently it's not going out to the stream, and God only knows why. Then again, let's remember, Skype was one of the things that they were listening in on. So they've got the metadata of our many conversations. I personally hope they enjoy them. Maybe they'll learn something, Sandra. All right, you take care. I'm sorry. Bye now. Well, I wonder what that was. I mean, that was Sandra. You couldn't hear, but what she said is absolutely true. They've got the metadata. And if they've got the metadata, they know who you were calling when you called. We didn't listen to the conversation. But do they have to listen to the conversation if it turns out that your call was to spankmeivebeennaughty.com? Or in the case of a certain Louisiana senator, never mind, I'm not going to go there. Yeah, we're not listening into you. But Sandra's right. She says, you know, I didn't vote for that. And who among us did? Well, apparently Lindsey Graham did. But, yeah, what the... So I'm going to try something here. Because I believe we've got someone on hold back in the home studio. Hopefully this will work. Because there's no reason this shouldn't be going into... Okay, so Agnes, you say we've got Dave in Portland. If you'd put him on, please. Wait, that's me. Agnes, would you mind turning me off? I didn't know I sound like that. That's bizarre. Agent Fred has many and wondrous powers. Yeah, Yeah, my producer back at the mansion just sent me a message. Wow. What in the hell's going on? I didn't mean turn me off that. You guys. Okay, Agnes, can you bring Dave on? Are you there, Dave? Yeah. Okay, let me go ahead. No, you're not coming through either. No, I'm sorry. I tested everything, but sometimes everything doesn't work. This is bizarre. This is the one thing that we could count on working through the course of it. I'm sorry, Dave. I apologize. I hear you. You hear me. But the machine, the thing that sends us out to the... that's why. Hold on just a damn minute. Okay, just a second. Dave, are you still there?
Can you hear me?
Yes, we all hear you now. And let me just put out a message out there. Hey, Sandra, I fixed the problem. So after Dave, if you want to jump back in. I'm sorry we had to engineer on the fly, but, you know, welcome to the horn, Dave.
Yeah, no problem. I just was, it seemed like I was hearing like the first hour of the show for the last 15 minutes.
And I got no clue why that was going on.
Yeah, I really enjoy listening to your show a number of times over because of your interesting guests. But this was kind of strange. So interesting subject matter. Interesting things going on. I think I'm so bothered by all of this. All this Monsanto stuff too. You know, I got a few cats. I used to have a few cats. I had three cats. And two of them died. You know. I think it's all that crap they're putting in the food.
Well, I mean, if it's cats, if it's cats, I mean, your cat food probably came from China. remember where wasn't President Obama on his way to a meeting with some with the leader of the Chinese authoritarian dictatorship today, when all this broke for him?
I don't know.
I think he was.
I'm not even paying much attention to what Obama's doing anymore because I know he's just, I don't know. People would just have to come around to realizing what's going on. I think that we're all just, you know, I don't know. I think that the problem that's been going on the last, 12 years and 5 months, okay, and even longer than that, it's just been this divide and conquer. And the more and more I see them taking over, the more and more I think we all agree that, you know, it's what's going on.
Well, this is one of those textbook moments, Dave, when you realize that you're descending into fascism.
You know, the thing that is really eye-opening is that descending into fascism, I think the government was overthrown 12 years and 5 months ago. And I think this Obama is, I don't want to make any excuses at all for Obama because I am not down with anything that he's doing now. I really am not. I was disillusioned within 3 months of his coming into office over the whole healthcare thing because I was really paying attention a lot then, and I keep paying attention, but it seems to me that this has just been, that the government was overthrown 12 years and 3 months ago, and Obama is just the new guy, and he's playing hardball trying to survive, and
I asked that non-rhetorical question earlier in the program, you know, what are the diehard Obama defenders saying now? Because they're out there. I mean, There's a group of people out there that if Barack Obama was saving kittens from burning trees, they would swear that he was only doing it because he thought they were barbecued and he could eat them now. On the other hand, there's a group of people who, if Barack Obama was eating barbecued kittens, would say that he was a damned fine cook.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, the thing about all those right-wingers is they're misinformed, and they believe things that aren't true, and I think it's the same problem we have over here. I think that what we need to do, what they've been playing over the past 20, 30 years has been this divide and conquer game, and it's worked very, very well for them. And I think that the only antidote to it all is for us all, right, left, center, wherever, to realize what is going on and move on from there. You know, I just don't, a lot more and more I see things in the news that, on a human level, on the level where we are, just ordinary folks, I agree with a lot of these people who don't trust the government on the right. On the other hand,
except for the fact that they're nuts. They don't trust the government. They don't trust the government because of Agenda 21. And they don't trust the government because that Kenyan Muslim's going to get all our guns. And they don't trust the government because there's going to be UN troops in Lubbock, for Christ's sakes.
Sure. But on the other hand, I think they're deluding themselves that they think their guns are going to protect them, because they have much advanced weaponry that a gun is nothing. Yeah, I mean, there's no way that they could defend themselves or even, you know, hope that they control the government with a gun, even with a high-powered assault weapon or anything like that. It's just a joke. I think that the thing is that I'm seeing more and more realization that of reality, like global warming, for instance. I was reading an article today about how in Georgia, the Tea Party of all groups is really pissed about the fact that the government there is not providing enough incentive for solar power. And it was kind of knocked me on my ass a little bit to read this story, because I was going like, what?
Yeah, Georgia Power.
Yeah.
Well, Georgia Power is owned by the Southern Company, just like Alabama Power is owned by the Southern Company. Yeah, there's some Tea Party. The Tea Party of Georgia has found some unlikely allies in solar and wind power advocates. And you know, this much I respect. They said a central tenet of the Tea Party has always been the free market.
Right.
And the Southern Company has a monopoly in several states, and that is not the free market. And that's a brilliant little opening of a window there, Dave, because, one of the reasons that what is in Germany is called the Energiewende has worked so well is that people have more or less gone into the energy business for themselves with their rooftop solar and their wind.
Right.
It all feeds into a distributed grid that is the direct antithesis of the entire model that obtains with most power companies in the United States.
Right, exactly. And I think that some of these folks that want to get off the grid, I think they're survivalist types, and they want to just be independent of it all. I mean, I think there's some component there where we all would be better off if we were. The whole thing about what's going on right now is it's centralized control, and it's energy and centralized control. And I think that, you know, when we talked about tests getting out in the streets, I mean, I was out in the streets in 2003 when we went to war, and it was like they hurt us. I mean, I think boycotts work a lot better. I think the boycotting and the things that you don't like, you don't buy.
Well, I mean, I think there are some models that have shown us that boycotting can work better than most of us thought. Look at the wild success that Stop Rush has had, Dave.
That's awesome. That was an awesome. I was really.
And it hasn't quit. It's not let up.
Right.
So.
Right. So Boycotts, I think boycotts do work, and those are, you know, the most dangerous thing, I think, to the power structure is ideas and thinking about, like, maybe, marching in the streets is not going to be as effective as taking more of a Gandhi approach and sitting down and saying, no more type of, approach. I don't know. Unless you want to get your head knocked in or thrown in jail. I had a friend, I think I told you about my friend who went to Washington and demanded hold the banks responsible. She got thrown in jail and then they let her out. They were actually very nice to her. They didn't beat her up or anything like they're doing all over the country. Cops are doing all over the country, but, you know, it's pretty ineffectual. Whereas, boycotting, I think, you hit them where it hurts. You hit them where you can't.
See, in the Southern Company case with the Tea Party in Georgia and the progressives that aligned with them, you know, this is not the reason that you've got to do something differently is simply because utilities, as a matter of public policy, were granted monopolies. So you have no choice but to do business with them if you want electricity.
Right.
Well, so it's hard to run a boycott on somebody who holds a government-sanctioned monopoly.
Right. Well, the PE's people, whatever political strength they are, need to get off the grid then and just tell them to screw themselves, get their own solar panels on their house and have their own in-home system, and just disconnect, cut them, go up there and their Tea Partiers climb up the pole and with a, you know, better get some big gloves on, but cut the cable.
Yeah.
Cut the cord. It just seems like all this centralized control is, they're very paranoid because they know that's where we're headed.
Well, and so the other pathetic attempt that the federal government made to excuse the data mining today was the fact that, well, we're not data mining on Americans, we're data mining on foreigners. So,
oh, right.
But the thing is, this is the internet, right, Dave? If you go through, if you go into a server in, Poland, the world becomes a very small place when you're inside cyberspace. Well, see, we only access the Polish server, but guess what? You can access the World Wide Web through that Polish server, or I don't know, a Croatian server, or you get the idea.
Whatever server anywhere, yeah. Whatever server anywhere. I think I don't want to change lanes here too much, but I have some things that we may not see eye to eye on that I would like to just bring up that maybe food for thought. But we have to do some really hard things, and I think that one of the toughest things is to talk to people that we disagree with the most, and all of a sudden we'll see we agree with them about a lot of things, and if we talk to people we can enlighten them into our ideas and finding common ground is the
well. Tell me who you want to do that with, and I'll tell you whether you've got a fighting chance of accomplishing the goal.
Well, I'll be the judge of whether I have a fighting chance with anybody, but the point is that I would say that I think more and more I'm seeing signs that people all across the country are disillusioned with what's going on. And, I think our culture has taken a really, really dark, dark turn toward, it's just gotten so mean. And, it's like, the hardest thing to do is to talk to people that are on the other side and opposite ideas in a lot of ways to us because, you know, it's like, I'm hearing all about this case out in Colorado about the guy that shot up that theater And everyone's saying, oh, well, you know, don't give him a second chance, this or that or the other thing. But it seems like the evidence that I've heard, I don't know the case in depth, but it sounds like the guy really reached out and was trying to get some help. And all of a sudden, you know, he went off the rails. And it's wrong that it's too easy to get a gun. But, you know, when something like that happens, we have to kind of look at the situation and be human beings about it, really think about deeply about what's going on here. Somebody can't get help. I don't know. I'm just seeing such a lack of compassion and humanity in people.
Well, so far we're in a total state of agreement. This is, and that happens in fascist societies, Dave. They become dehumanizing. The social glue that ties us together is some degree of concern for our mutual well-being.
They've been playing divide and conquer, and what you have to do is to do the hardest thing, which is fight that you know, base human nature within us that tells us, well, this guy wants a gun. Well, maybe we need to think about, like, why he wants a gun. He's really paranoid because the government is lying to us, and it's Barack Obama, and it was George Bush, and it was Bill Clinton before that, and all the way back to, I think, the last decent president. You were talking about Jimmy Carter. That malaise speech, you know, Jimmy Carter pissed off a lot of people, a lot of the oligarchs, because he was talking about doing things the right way, like getting off of our dependence on oil, and every person that has followed him from the worst Reagan on down has said this: energy independence starts at home, I think, and you got to just get off this dependence. And Al Gore talked about it. He was another, you know, I mean, think about what the country would have been like if he had gotten elected, or if he had gotten put into the presidency after he got elected.
Right, but both Carter and Gore have been reduced to walking human cartoons.
Not in your mind, but
certainly by the for-profit media, Dave, and certainly by the right wing in this country.
And whatever they have to say, I mean, we just all have to come around to the realization that whatever they say is the opposite of the truth. That's all. It's real easy. It's a real easy formula. You know, when I hear people talk, when I hear the political elite, and I used to think it was just the Republicans, but it's both sides. When I hear them talk, you have to hear that through a filter, and it's kind of like a mirror, like they're saying the truth is the opposite of what they're saying. Pretty much. I don't know. Just to try to figure out what's going on when any one of them makes a promise to me, and it was sad and disillusioning to me.
Well, let me say this, Dave. I am deeply disturbed. I am furious over I guess the revelation that something I had thought was true is true. That these guys are data mining for all they're worth, and they're gathering telephone data. You know, the cynical side of me says, well, yeah, okay, and you know, so we know that what we thought was true is true, and it makes me furious. But on the other side of that, I'm kind of trying to stay a little bit focused here, because this is an abrogation of our civil liberties that goes all the way to the very heart of what kind of country we are. On the other hand, whatever kind of country we are, there is a significant group of people in this country who want to destroy it. And that, you know, that's existential too. So, you know, I hate to say this. But if Daryl Issa and those jackasses in the House take this ball and run with it, well, I'm sure they'd love to impeach Barack Obama over it, But Daryl Issa's hands are all over this. John Boehner's hands are all over this. Eric Cantor's hands are all over this. The Democratic leadership's hands may largely be all over this. Because every, and in the House and the Senate both, because they all signed off on it in December 2012 and reauthorized this BS.
Right.
So they're going to be hard pressed to do any impeaching over this.
Yeah.
But this is the part I don't want to say, but I'm going to say it anyway. Is there any doubt that if it came out that this was an initiative of the executive branch done without the knowledge of the legislative branch, that there would be impeachment proceedings instituted against Barack Obama? Is there any doubt, Dave?
No.
Okay, so let's take this into consideration. The Bush administration did exactly that.
Yeah.
They engaged in the beginnings of this domestic spying, and basically Congress was left to hang fire. I remember when Dennis Kucinich stood in the well of the House and read out the articles of impeachment of Dick Cheney. And I also remember when Nancy Pelosi famously, infamously declared that impeachment is off the table.
I'll never forget that. That was a milestone in my mind in terms of, you know, disillusionment and all of it. I think that we need to look back to the overthrow of the government we knew and grew up with, Bob. I don't know. We have to go back a long way before that to realize what, I mean, it was, I don't know. I just didn't think that we were just living in the world of illusion. I was, like I say, I was out in protesting in 2003 when we were about to go to war, and I never saw a bigger crowd here in Portland, and I know there were huge crowds all over the world. No, you just ignored us. We have to figure
out.
The for-profit media,
to the for-profit media, it largely didn't exist.
Absolutely, yeah. I think that you think that for-profit media didn't exist?
No. To the for-profit media, all those millions around the globe protesting the war didn't exist.
Okay, I got you. Because yeah, they just ignored us too, and they were totally on board for the run-up. I think that we just have to accept reality and move on to action in a way that will be effective rather than in ways that won't be effective. And I think that, you know, I think a lot about the alternative energy, and I think that you know, the real value in our the key component, the key element in a value in our economy now is energy. And if we can get out of the dependence on the centralized authority control source, I would say, of energy, that is to say, it's slow and it's on a personal level, but we have to do it. Get solar or get wind or get off, get out of it. Because then we're not giving any more money to the powers that be. Then we are making our we go from dependent like children to independent people. And we make our own energy and we don't need them for that. Because that's the thing that's hammering people, I think, the most now. And that's the reason why we go to war now. That's the whole key to it all, I think. It's getting off of this and getting off of this centralized authority and centralized control of our economy. And going out of the streets, I mean, I'm an activist, but I've done things that I feel good about as an activist, but I think that we have to find other ways and figure out other ways to resist the overall authority. You hear me?
Yeah, I'm right here.
I think it's just, It's just like.
But see, the structure, and I'm not just trying to say no, and I'm not, that's not what I'm doing. I'm trying to point out the difficulties that are inherent in this. And frankly, it may be easier, to the extent easy can be, is a word that can be used. It may be easier to do something like that in a state like Oregon or Washington or California than it is, you know, for instance, where I live. Okay? Because there may be legislative structures in place that make it easier. But how do you tell somebody who doesn't have the money for solar panels or doesn't have the money for wind turbines, who lives up a holler in West Virginia, that they need to get off the grid?
Well, you might have to do it on a gradual basis. And this is what I've thought about a lot too. I say, well, you know, what I've asked the same question myself in my own mind, saying, well, how do you do that? And I don't know what you drive. You drive a pickup truck, maybe. Maybe go and get a Geo Metro that gets 3 times the mileage or twice the mileage, and you're using half as much, and you're weaning yourself off of it.
Well, what do you mean, Dave, when you say go and get?
Well, $1,500 will get you a Geo Metro, and then you'll be using half the gas or a third of the gas. Whatever you can do to get off of it, or ride a bike, or I'm riding my bike a lot more because I lost my car that got great mileage, and now I've got a van that doesn't get great mileage, so I ride my bike a lot. I was just downtown today. I rode my bike down there, and I'm just, you know, I do whatever you can do to reduce your footprint, because it's not just the environment, but it's money out of your pocket. I mean, I don't think that everybody can take action because the strategy now is to put everybody in poverty, but anybody that can take action needs to take action. And everybody, in any way they can. And I just, to eat meat even is, I'm eating a lot less meat now because it's gotten down to the point that's good for you anyway, all the crap they're putting in it.
I can't remember the last time I bought a steak.
I like steak. I really do. I love steak, but I've just gotten down to the point where it doesn't make me feel that good after I've eaten one. And I don't know what they're putting in this stuff anymore too. I just don't even trust the food industrial complex. Like I said, it killed a couple of my cats, and I just, I'm trying to eat as healthy as I possibly can. I got a garden in the yard, and I mean, little things add up when everybody does it.
Right. And you know, you mentioned a garden just so you can have a better working understanding of, for instance, what the reality is where I live.
Sure.
You know, hillbillies have gardened for years, generations. You know, long before World War II victory gardens, there was subsistence gardening. And folks,
right.
You know, canning for the winter. And I mean, it was very serious business. It was also delicious. What do you do when you find out that the garden ground is toxic with polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons? You know, an entire laundry list of cancer-causing chemicals that will be uptaken by whatever you plant there. What do you do when those same polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons are covering and infesting, say, the fresh apples hanging on your tree in summer?
Well, I would just say this from my life experience. I lived here in Portland for 8 years. I moved back to Los Angeles, which is my hometown, and I got very sick there. I had a lot of problems. The environment down there is disgustingly dirty, and I was an environmentalist. I got pneumonia there. I almost died because the smog there is horrible. And I realized I had to get the hell out. And at some point, you figure, like, it took me a couple of years of just scraping together the money to get the hell out of there. And I got the hell out to some place where I could be, where I could survive, because I knew I wouldn't have survived there in Los Angeles. My mom got pneumonia when she was down there, and she ended up dying of lung cancer, which I think that, you know, she had moved up here and she had lived up here for 10 years. But I think that it had a lot to do with her life down there in Los Angeles. You know, that cancer takes a long time to manifest itself. But and I know other people that have died of pneumonia down there because the air is dirty and fetid and disgusting. And I understand it probably better than a lot of people. But I just, you know, there comes a point at which I know, you know, that's your ancestral home. California was my ancestral home. It was. My great-great-great-grandfather came through Mariposa Pass in 1868. Okay? So California is where I came from. But I just figured I had to make a, I had to get away to someplace where I could survive. You know, and that's a hard freaking reality to come up face to face with, but you know, it was a reality that I had to deal with, or cuz I couldn't survive down there. I just had to get away. And you know, mass migrations have been forecast.
Oh, I think they're probably coming. I think they're coming as a result of climate change. I think they're going to come as a result of sea level rise. Will it be within my lifetime? I don't know, but it's coming. There's going to
So you got to figure to yourself, well, where can I go? I got to get away. Where can I go? I got to get away. And that was my thing. That was in 1995. Okay, so this didn't start yesterday. And I know it's terrible out there, and if you want to stay there, try to work to make it a better place to live, and try to somehow to get something survival, you know, in the form of food, try to get something survivable that you can eat and live. But
if we can just get them to stop poisoning us, we've got a fighting chance, Dave.
Right. Well, the best way to, there's no way to fight them head on. They've got the government. They've got the power. The only way to fight them is to not take part in it, and to take an attitude of just like, and get away to a safe place, and that's been my strategy. And I got down to Los Angeles, and there's things I love about down there, and it would be paradise if they would get rid of all the gasoline cars and all the smog and clean the place up. But it's pretty badly poisoned down there too. You know, they've got a lot of the place is in pretty bad shape down there, but they're working on cleaning it up, and it doesn't happen overnight. But I, for my part, I just had to get out of there, and I had to get somewhere where I could survive. So, you know, I don't know what's maybe Maine or Vermont or something. I don't know what's close to you what's within reasonable distance of you. But if you want to stay there,
are they now? This is a very, very frustrating conversation for me, Dave, because I've had parts of it before. And, you know, there are places I think I could be happy that aren't West Virginia. But sooner or later, if things continue in the vein that both of us suspect they will, there's going to be a problem wherever we go. I fell in love. I mean, I absolutely fell in love with northern Wisconsin. And there's a hillbilly who's trying to blow that straight to hell even as we speak, and it's some of the prettiest country I've ever seen in my life, most brilliant ice cold, crystal clear water burbling out of artesian wells there in Ashland. Oh my God! And the people are wonderful, but they're not giving away free land in Ashland County.
I'm sure of it.
And I can't keep this we struggle to keep this radio operation going. And all we do is try to raise the money to pay the bills for it.
I understand.
And frankly, I'm not ready to get in touch with my inner Jode and ask my family to go play Grapes of Wrath with me.
Yeah, well, I think a little while ago, about two and a half years ago, I bought a van. I bought a Dodge Ram van. And the car that I was driving at the time, I have this Toyota truck, but it's got the clutch went out and that. And I've been driving that Ram van a lot, and I've thought a lot about that. And a couple of friends of mine said to me, "Wow, man, you're ready to go Grapes of Wrath of that thing." And I said, "Yeah, maybe." You know, I mean, I something in me when I saw the van, I thought, wow, this is real cool, and it runs great. It's terrible mileage, but it's a nice little driver. I stay here because because from my judgment of places I've been, it's the best place to be. But, you know, if you're in a place where bad, you got a choice, I guess, of either trying to make it better, which is what I think you're trying to do, or to moving on. And I don't know. I don't have all the answers for everybody. I can only answer for myself. Was that I had to? I love California, but I had to get out of there because I could tell I wouldn't survive there, and it just was not right. I did what I had to do.
I get it. I understand. You know, my reality is perhaps somewhat slightly different. I got younger human beings for whom I'm responsible.
That's a
or for whom my wife and I are responsible. It's not like, you know, not like me and that mouse in my pocket.
But you can. It costs more, but you can probably get something fresher and better quality food, and get a water purification system. Drink a lot of water. I think that getting off the grid, though, is something that a lot of people are just coming around to realizing that it's what's taking the biggest bite out of everyone's budget right now anyway. It's energy costs. You know, if people, I know that maybe you can't afford this right now, and I surely can't, but if people could get a solar system on their house and an electric charger on their electric car, then they're off the grid. And,
well, you know, people have tried to get the legislature of the state of West Virginia even remotely interested, for instance, in a feed-in tariff. I'm not unfamiliar with these concepts.
Absolutely.
And that went over like a turd in a punch bowl there in the land of coal freedom.
Well, you got to just, it's all about, I've read history and you know, Washington lost all the battles and won the war, and you lose battles and you just keep coming back, and it's not about winning battles, it's about winning the war, and I think that overall, sooner or later, stuff has to break. It just has to. It's got to break if we're going to survive. We got to just keep at it, and it's gratifying when you go and you try to do something and it works the first time, but I don't think that happens very much. I think
no, it doesn't happen very often at all. And, you know, the other side of this coin is, and you know, people, for instance, who know Cleveland or Akron or places like that can tell you what it's like to live around a displaced hillbilly, a hillbilly refugee. We don't do well outside of Appalachia, generally speaking. I mean, you know, we'll do okay. I mean, we'll survive and stuff. Sometimes we'll thrive, but you know what? We never stop pining. Stop pining for the hills, and because that's how we are, and because a lot of us are Scots-Irish, our inclination is to stand and fight the bastards until they beat us to our knees, and then keep swinging until they've lopped our arms off.
Well, there you go. Then that's your plan, then, and just you got a plan. And I would say that
I wouldn't call that a plan, Dave. I'd call that pig-headed stubbernness, the hillbilly word for it is cussedness.
I think that's a plan.
But in a way, that's what we're doing here in Washington D.C. You know,
absolutely.
This is
fighting.
This is damn tiring work, but. But you know, we've made a decision that we are not going to let these people ignore us to death. We're going to make them know we're going to make them say no if say no. The easy thing is to say yes and help us pass this thing. But if they say no, we're going to make them say no and dip their hands in the blood and look at it and wear it and wipe it on their faces. Figuratively speaking, of course, because we're being listened to.
Okay, well, this is just I was thinking of this story that I wanted to just tell quickly. I had this experience when I was younger, when I was a teenager. I used to walk by this auto shop, and there was this guard dog inside the yard of the auto shop, and this dog would bark at me, and we'd growl at everybody. It was a mean dog. And I walked by him, and I kind of liked him for some reason. I don't know why, but I just liked him. And I thought to myself, gee, I would love to be able to make friends with that dog, but he would never let me near him. And I one day I was thinking, like, oh, I got it. I went to the store and I got some hamburger meat. And I went and I looked at this dog and he growled at me and I had the hamburger meat and his ears came up and I threw him some of it. And we became real good friends. Every time I would go by the dog after that, he would wag his tail and his ears would go up and he was, all of a sudden we were buddies. And I think, sometimes, you know, you have to kind of think a little bit out of the box sometimes with people. And if they're saying things that are pissing you off, or you, they believe something that's the opposite of what you believe, it's hard. It's not easy, but you have to kind of like try to overcome that and try and really, really think on kind of a high level, like what is going on here? What is making them think this way? Well, I'll bet if they knew me, they would like me, because I like you, Bob, and I think if anybody knew you down deep, that they would like you, because I mean...
Oh, know, no, those mountaintop removal people hate my freaking guts and would prefer to see me dead.
Well, they got to... I'm not talking about them, but I'm talking about everybody else in West Virginia, or anybody else in West Virginia, and anybody else anywhere else. And not necessarily.
Well, I'm a likable guy. I try to be fairly genial.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, the point I'm getting at is, if I encounter people that I disagree with sometimes, and I take it slow, and I just try to figure out what is it, and you know, people will express things to me that the ideas that I just am totally against, and then I just have to. Take a step back and think, like, okay, if there's any chance of me convincing them of the opposite of what they believe, how would I do that? Instead of thinking, like, this stupid son of a bitch has his head in his ass. You know what I'm saying?
I'm nice to everybody.
Yeah, I know. But I'm not saying you're not. But what I'm saying is that you know, taunting that dog in the yard of the garage where I used to walk by wouldn't make him my friend. I talked to him in the language that he understood, and I related to him with values that he wanted something to eat. And he was probably a poor dog, was abused by whoever trained him to be a guard dog. And I think, you know, sometimes I think I told you this before, like sometimes when I used to be a car salesman and I'd meet people on the car lot and they would have a bad attitude, and I just asked them straight up. I said, was another salesman really, really abusive and rude to you? And they would look at me like, whoa, you know, because that's exactly probably what happened, or what they believed would happen, or, you know, and when I took it that way, I broke through that armor, so to speak, that they had around themselves, that there was, you know, because it's usually a protective psychological mechanism that's going on when they come off that way, or they were taught to believe the way they believe by somebody that told them the wrong thing. Does that make sense?
Well, it does. It does.
It's tough.
And like I said, you know, I don't, you know, I do fairly well in public. You know, I don't scratch my ass and then eat with my hands or anything or.
No, I'm not saying you do.
But I'm also saying that there is a distinct possibility that, Dave, you have never met the like of a mountaintop removal worker. And I don't mean that figuratively. I mean literally.
Well, that's how they make money. So you're talking, when you disagree with them, you're talking about taking away their livelihood. So maybe you need to, some people, this was my thing. I'm not talking about a 100% success formula here. Some people you have to say, and this was the same thing when I was selling cars. I would meet some people and say, oh, this isn't going to work. And I would know really pretty quick, like, your success rate is not going to be good with the mountaintop removal people. You have to talk to everybody else. The other 95% of people in West Virginia, or the other 90% of people in West Virginia that are not that invested into it. Some people here, or whatever the percentage is. There's some people that you're never going to convince, and you can accept that and move on and not expect to bat 1,000 with people, you know, convince everybody. But if you convince 90% of the people, then you're doing better than 90% of the people could ever hope to do. You know what I'm saying? It's kind of a thing that you have to be realistic. My thing is, I'm into people being successful and talking to one another, and that takes, that's not so easy if we have different outlooks, different beliefs, different backgrounds, different things. We have to get on the same page with people, and that's about building rapport, and then you move on from there, and you still might have arguments. I mean, it's not a perfect world. I'm not saying you're wrong in any of your beliefs. I'm just suggesting a way that you and me and anybody else can move forward and meet with people that we've been, the people on top have been working on dividing us for so long. And the best thing we can do, the best way to fight back is to come together. When we all come together, then they lose. You know, it's been divide and conquer. So we need to unite and conquer them.
I do, and I'm all for finding common cause where people are willing in good faith to pursue it.
We speak a different language. You and I speak logically. We speak a different language than other people. Sometimes, you know, you talk to people and they just talk past you, or you talk past them, they can't understand you. It's like we're speaking different languages. You and I speak the same language. I can listen to you, and I can understand you, and that's why I call you, is because I like your show a lot. And you say, I think we agree on probably 95% of the issues. I'm sure of it. And if we don't, you can explain to me how you feel, and I can explain to you. You can listen to me. See, you're listening to me. And we can meet, our minds can meet. It's like the Vulcan mind meld or something. But, it's like we have to try and communicate with these people that speak a different language and try to understand them and try to understand why some guy goes crazy in a theater instead of condemning him to death immediately, saying like, what happened here? What's wrong with this guy? What led him to this? What, you know, instead of just, it's just about, we gotta be human with one another. And that's a tough thing to do. It's really, it's the opposite of human nature, of animal nature, of reflex and all that. You know, that's just what that's the way I feel more and more is that, you know, I want to meet people. I love talking to you. But I really, really want to meet people that I disagree with the most and try to figure it. I mean, I've talked to conservatives and I stop them in their tracks. Because I take the time to try to relate to them, to try to build rapport with them. And then I ask them questions. I don't make assertions. I just ask them questions. I demand that they think, because questions make you think. When I'm asking them questions, I won't even, it's like a Socratic method. You know, that's why they did in Socrates. Because he asked too many questions and made people think about things they don't want to think about, and then made them feel really, you know, made them take a second look.
Well,
does that make sense?
Yep. I understand.
It is tough. It's a tough, tough thing to get through, and I just.
But listen. I mean. I used the words good faith a few minutes ago, Dave, and, you know, I don't believe it. I'll be honest. I don't believe it's possible to walk into a whole bunch of teabaggers and really have much of a meaningful conversation. What happened in Atlanta, Georgia is the exception and not the rule.
But it takes, you know, sometimes things take a little longer than we'd like them to take, but you can explain something to me rationally, Bob, and I would understand it rationally. But not everybody thinks that way. And so it takes some time, and it's hard, and it's like fighting. You have to, you know, losing battles and winning a war. And it's like,
they're doing the same thing over in Palmdale, like Percy got back, or in Lancaster, whatever, over in north of L.A. They want to go all silver over there, and that's a very conservative community. And these conservative communities, you see, they're slowly moving in the logical, in the reasonable, in the realistic direction that where we are now. We can't expect them to overnight come to these realizations. It's taking them longer. It's like a child. You have daughters. You would not have tried to teach your daughter to walk, and she had never walked. She just crawled, and you put her up on her 2 feet. She fell down, and you said, well, forget it. She'll never learn to walk, right? She said, just forget it. Let's just, you know, get her a wheelchair or whatever. You would never do that. It took you a long time, and she probably messed a few diapers before you got her toilet trained, too. And that stuff takes a long time. And so we have to be patient with people. And it's hard because, you know, they're adults and they're still crapping their pants maybe in their reasoning. But we have to look at it that way. And we have to really, it's hard work. It's hard work raising a kid, don't you think?
I know it is. That much I know for a fact. Hey, Dave, I've got to run because there are other folks on hold. But I really appreciate the deep thought and the passionate commitment you have and have brought to this conversation this evening. I sincerely do.
All right, man. I always love talking to you. Have a good one, all right?
Take care, Dave. Bye now.
All right. Bye-bye.
That's Dave calling from Portland. And let's go to Bill. Is Bill still with us, Agnes?
Yeah, good evening.
Hey, Bill. How are you?
Well, an old guy. I had a rough one last night. I got up, and the guy who was hosting the jam session was the guy who has my last job, and I got up and I had to blow him back to where he came from, and that's not easy when you're 70. I was hurting after that. My wind was going, you know. Get up and try to play like that when you used to be. This guy's using a harmonica that he's paying $75 for that are tuned specially, that are special design. And yeah, well, when you can't play, you got to learn how. You got to buy something that can play itself.
Oh, that's a dentist harmonica, isn't it?
Yep.
You know, because there's dentist guitars out there and dentist harmonicas and dentist cameras. You know, the stuff that a real working pro can't buy.
Blues is, yeah, well, I was paying Lee Oscar. I had a Lee Oscar designed. Oscar was with the harmonica player with War. He was a Danish kid, and he put his name on one. And then you could replace the whole reed plate, which was nice. You could save a buck. And they had a tone, because Oscar had a great tone, if you remember War.
Oh, yeah.
He wasn't any Chicago or mid-60s, and my whole style is based on a guy out of Chicago in 65 named Paul Butterfield.
Oh, he's sure.
And so it was fun, but, I was thinking, I just did two books, one that was called Tears of Darkness, which is the memoirs of a young man from Montana, joined the Army in 40, got a trip to the Philippines in 41. Got a trip to Japanese POW camps and a trip down the death march. And when I read that stuff, it makes me scream. You know, the Japanese militarists. I don't think people in this country know how bad those guys were. Because they treated their own soldiers like dogs.
Yeah, oh yeah.
They would, and they had a medical unit up there with a number attached to it in Manchuria that was a Mengele unit. That was doing all kind of medical experiments and such. And, I don't like the dropping of the atomic bomb. Who the hell does? But if it had ended the war in 42, and you started putting the bodies up, piling them one pile here and one pile, it would have been a lot smile. I mean, what the Japanese did in China, what they did in any place they put their feet. Hell, what the French did in Indochina. And it's not a nationality thing. It's a human behavior thing. It doesn't. I caught a guy's show a couple nights ago where he covered the German Imperial Army in 1864, 66, 70, and 14. And my great-grandfather fought for the Kaiser in 64 and 66, and that's what brought him to this country.
Yeah, that's when he decided to...
he thought Lorraine...
Exercise his exit clause?
Yeah, exactly. He told my grandfather there's only so many times you can have so many guys shoot at you, and you're not going to make it. But this book, Tears in Darkness, this guy ended up going to the Cleveland Institute of Art, and he taught art in Montana for years, and it's enough to make you when you, and what bothers me, of course, is it comes back home. Military behavior comes back home to us at this. I'm not happy with what our people have done. And my second father-in-law was a Marine who fought on Saipan, Tinian, and Iwo. And we'd fish late at night, and he'd tell me about things that he said that bothered him in the 40s, and they said, I don't like him now because he saw things done. My guys were in the same uniform he did that he didn't really appreciate. So I don't know. Your last caller has... I have friends like that from the 60s, and sometimes you can... Sometimes you, there are people in this world, I hate to say this, but there are some people you can't seem to reason with. That's what scares me. And especially,
because they have rejected the concept out of hand.
Well, the cash flow really interests them. I don't know if I ever told you, I did two commercials in 67 for William Saxby when he was running for Senate.
No, you didn't.
I was downtown at a place that had a good Dixieland band, and I was sitting in with those guys, and this fat guy comes up to me who was a producer of a television show in Cleveland and a political consultant. And I did two commercials. One was a kid throwing rocks at school buildings, and the other one was playing My Country, 'Tis of Thee, while people carried protest signs. And the producer of those commercials, which got written up in Newsweek later on, they weren't criticizing my playing. They didn't like the negativity of the commercials. The producer was a guy named Roger Ailes, 1968.
Oh, Jesus.
Yeah, when Saxby was running, they had paid me $100 for 7 minutes of my time. And 67, I was, oh, my God, 24 years old. Yeah, I'll take it. And now I look back, because it got written up in Newsweek because of the negativity of those commercials. And, there was so much going on at the time. I was playing at a teen club, Hullabaloo Teen Club in Lake County on a Saturday, May 1st. Kids came in and told me they had just burned the ROTC building in Kent. And what would happen May 4th, Bob?
Wow.
Yeah. And my first thought, being a half-assed knowledge of the New York draft riots of 1863 and what happened there, my first thought was, I don't know if they're going to let you get away with that one. Because the National Guard was out in force because of a truck strike. But one thing the National Guard didn't do was clash with striking truckers during that truck strike. You know why, don't you? You don't know what those truckers might do to you.
Amen.
Because that was still close enough to the days of labor when... I'm sure you know who... about Ruther and a guy named Frankenstein up on a bridge in Detroit in the 30s.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
People attacked them.
You know the Ruther boys are hillbillies, right? West Virginians.
I didn't know they were.
Yep.
I was working for the Wall Street Journal doing a minor league job, and they did a story on the guy was running the miners union in those days. Didn't he get assassinated?
Oh, are you talking about the whole Yablonsky?
Yes. Yeah, but when he was running the UMW of A. Because, you know, a household name in my household was John L. Lewis.
Sure.
And he was a hero to those of us who had labor, you know, in our blood, you know. The organized labor was something that I believe heavily in, and to this day I believe in, and I think that it's slipping away. I don't know. What's your opinion on that?
Look, this... I hate to be the harbinger of horrid news, But I don't think I'm talking to anybody here, least of all you, Bill. This country's going to hell, and it is being deliberately dismantled. That's the problem with some of what Dave was talking about. The people, it's hard to have a dialogue with somebody who's busy putting a brick through your national window.
Yes. Yeah. Some of these folks are just, their minds are so... I remember my mother talking to me years after my grandmother came over here in 99 or 1900 from Germany. And after World War II, my mother told me my grandmother sat and cried as more and more was known about what Hitler pulled in the concentration camps. My grandmother couldn't believe that this was the nation that she was born into. And one of my best friend's fathers was a lieutenant on a German U-boat. He was one of the English took him prisoner and kicked him out at Bremen. And he was making his way across Germany trying to get home. And here come the Russians looking for labor. And some lady on the truck with him said, oh, this is my husband, blah, blah, blah. And he ended up being married for like 50 years and having four kids. So you hear some of these stories. But this tears in darkness, this guy ended up teaching. He went to the Institute of Art here in Cleveland, and which was another place where a lot of people came from that used to listen to me. And he taught in Montana. And that was one book. And the other one I'm working on is Retribution by Max Hastings, The Last 2 Years of the Pacific War. And I don't think Americans know in this country just how destructive the Japanese military machine was anywhere they put their foot. I mean, they were, the military class was unbelievable. With a medical unit doing, experimentation and the number of Chinese they killed, Nanking, I don't know whether they gloss it over or whether, sure it's depressing as hell, but you have to kind of know that some people, if given the wrong leadership, can be pushed in the wrong direction easily, it seems. Because the poor people back in Japan, the civilians, I don't think most of them knew what was going on in Asia.
No, fascism, Bill. Their job was to keep their heads down, participate in the trivialities of the day, and
it kind of scares me. I remember, a guy from your home state was standing in line with me in '64 when I voted for the first time. I voted for LBJ and peace, you know.
Right.
So much for that idea.
Well, it was a novel conceit, I suppose.
Yeah, I guess. You know, I realized how old I am when I realized that, you know, who was the president when I was born was FDR, for crying out loud. He was in his, he was going to run again and win again in 44, a year after I was born. He was going to run. And we thought with Johnson, and if you look at Johnson's, only his domestic record, it wasn't that bad.
I mean, the Great Society was brilliant. And the operative idea behind Medicare was brilliant. Yep. You know, that it would start at 65, and then a few years later it would be 55, and a few years later it would be 45, and then boom, universal single-payer health care before the right wing knew what had hit it. But Vietnam and LBJ's stance on Vietnam took all that straight to hell.
Mm-hmm. Well, there was just a book came out on audio on D&B and Foo. And you know that the Dulles brothers, John Foster was Secretary of State, Allen was head of the CIA, and they were trying to push Ike into full-scale support for the French in Indochina. We were supplying, hell, we loaned
America. Harry Truman had more or less rejected de Gaulle's calls for the U.S. to get muddied up over there. And then the Dulles boys and Eisenhower, and the next thing you know, well, we're airlifting crap. You know, it was the same story in Iran. Harry Truman rejected the idea of overthrowing Mohammad Mossadegh. Yep. And then Eisenhower came in, and Churchill was his old bosom pal.
Yep.
And so, boom.
Some of the same stuff they pulled in, too, you know.
Yeah. Yeah,
same
exactly.
But the one of the guys that Ike went to Matthew Ridgway, who, you know, he commanded the 82nd Airborne, and he had taken control of the U.N. ground forces in Korea. And he was chief of staff of the Army, and Ike approached him about helping the French, getting involved physically ourselves. And Ridgway basically came back and said, there's nothing in this for us. So here's a case where a military man actually leaned on the president not to get involved in 1954. With there was a plan for a massive air attack around Dien Phu, and they were talking atomic weapons.
Oh, Jesus.
From what I've read that in two or three good studies of that particular mess. And it was amazing because I was only 11 years old, but I remember TV shots of the camp at Dien Phu. In fact, what's his name? G-I-A-P? How does it pronounce it? Jap?
Jap. Jap.
Yeah, he was asked in later years who he thought were the best. And he said he thought the French professionals, man for man, were tougher than the American guys, because it was a comparatively small scale man for man situation. You know,
right.
The French have the massive air power, and I left a couple friends who were, you know, on that list in Washington, and they were drafted, and I tried to enlist in 61, and they wouldn't. I was 18, and they didn't think I was worth a shit. There wasn't a war on. 64 or 65, they're calling me up, wanting to change my draft classification. And me being either a smart guy or a coward, I don't know which one, I told them, no, you can't do that. I'm not interested. Because, you know, the peacetime army was a place to go to learn electronics or some kind of a skill.
Right.
A lot of guys did join. But when I was voting for president in 64, the guy standing behind me was a guy maybe 6-7 years older than me, and he was a West Virginia guy. He had taught me a little about car repair. He was good at that, and he taught me a little. And because that's where the working class was in those days.
Sure.
The pro-Kennedy. I wasn't a big Kennedy. I wasn't that big a JFK fan. I was stupid enough to think that Nixon maybe had something going on for him. But
no, a lot of people did.
Yeah, JFK's situation. His dad has a long history that we don't want to go into right now.
No.
But you and I know what it is. But I won't keep you because there's people. But those, so many things are just, it seems with history, it's a rehash of turning over the same ground over and over and over. And the coal miners, for God's sake, well, you've seen the movie Matewan, no doubt.
Oh, sure. Yeah, I've gotten a lot of it memorized.
Great film.
All we got in common is our misery, Joe Keenihan used to say, so the least we can do is share it.
Yeah, and especially the funny thing is they bring in those Europeans who are probably Austro-Hungarian, maybe, or Italian miners.
Yeah, they're Italians in the film.
Yeah, because that part of the world.
And they join right up.
Yeah, yeah. Because I don't know if people really know what organized labor. There's a couple of books on Henry Ford that just, the guy was a whack job. Build a good car.
Yeah, but he was an anti-Semitic proto-fascist.
Yeah, he was. When it came down to it, I had an uncle who was a halfway expert on Ford, and he had some stories that if we had time that would make you, you know, whether to laugh or cry about his behavior. Him and Harry Bennett, you know who Bennett was?
Yes.
Bennett ran Ford's police force.
Right.
And they went to Philadelphia, and Ford sold the River Rouge Railroad to the Pennsylvania line and came home with $7 million in cash and suitcases. Kind of a strange guy. I mean, can you imagine carrying $7 million bucks in cash today?
I could not do that and keep control of my wits.
Yeah.
Well, you know, because $7 million bucks back then is how many millions today?
Yeah. It's strange how things happen. As I say, my grandmother's sitting and crying, according to my mother, as she learned more and more about the Holocaust. And she kept saying, I can't believe this is the nation I left. Because it wasn't when I left. In fact, where she was born and raised is now part of Poland. They made land swaps. You know, the Poles were divided two or three times between the Austrian, German, and Russian empires.
Oh, yeah.
Down through European history, yeah, they were taken over. And another buddy of mine is Ukrainian, and he taught me about the Great Famine. And there was another minor famine in India where only about 3 million East Indians died. When the Japanese took Burma was the rice supplier to India. And, of course, what do you think happened to the rice supplier when the Japanese were running Burma?
Right, and then the Japanese had a need for the rice.
Mm-hmm. And even in Indochina, I just finished in this book, Retribution, the Japanese went into Indochina and took it away from the French. Because the French couldn't, you know, stop them. Who could in 1942? And to make a long story short, they had the Vietnamese not planting rice, but planting some other stuff that the Japanese Empire needed financially. And, of course, I didn't realize how many Vietnamese died in a famine created by this kind of behavior. And it wasn't the man on the street in Japan who was doing it. It was the guy in military uniform, and it was the men who ran the industrial combines who were doing it. Because that's where the money was, and they had the power to do it. Their military caste was a little bit crazy. It was still tied to that old Bushido stuff. That it's hard to believe it, but then again, look at how many people in this country are so hung up on religion from the 1850s and 60s, and they're still trying to force that down everybody's throat. And I got a problem with that, too. I was raised Catholic and altar boy, choir boy, all that.
I wanted to throw something out your way, Bill, knowing your love of reading and your love of history.
Reading I used to have when my eyes worked, but now it's
audiobooks. Sure.
I love it.
Again, this book is fiction, but you may remember our buddy Reverbo. He turned me on to this author. He's a world-famous writer, Japanese writer, by name Haruki Murakami. And it is fiction, and there's an overarching story to all of it, but it is terribly engrossing. But it all centers on the Manchurian campaign.
Oh, yeah.
And it's called, in English, it's called The Wind-Up Bird Chronicle. And I can't recommend it highly enough.
Well, the whole idea...
Because the history that Murakami brings into his fictional account is very much real and just absolutely draws you in.
Well, Bob, in a lot of ways, I was lucky. I met guys who actually flew the hump. Flew supplies from India to China. And the amount of money we poured into old Chiang Kai-shek was so immense you can't count it. And what happens to him within 4 years of the end of the war, he's running off of China with as much money as he could carry. His wife's brothers were both international money people. So here we go again.
Indeed.
You can count the reasons, and they're usually bank reasons.
Well, I do have to roll, but let me suggest this. Next time you know you're going to be out playing a gig and teaching some youngin a little bit about what for, shoot me an email in advance so that I can let people know if they want to go out and see you.
I don't know how much listenership you have up here in this area. I know... there's one guy down in Cuyahoga Falls who's a good guy, and of course Isaac, I know is a heavy listener and quite a man himself. So many of the listeners impressed the hell out of me. It makes me feel like I'm a moron sometimes. Some of these guys.
Well, same thing happens to me.
So sharp, you know. Well, Bob, that's the whole reason to have the show, because you're bringing in things that a lot of us don't hear about because they don't appear in the newspapers, do they?
Sometimes
a friend of
not.
Mine just sold land to the Frackers, and she's telling me how
oh,
much.
Oh, no.
I just shake my head. Yeah, she's down around Youngstown. In fact, her backyard is the big military place that's been down there. It's the arsenal down there. I can't think of the name of the arsenal, but it's still in operation. It was in operation in World War II, of course. Anyway, take care of yourself.
You have a great weekend, Bill. It's good to talk to you. I hope we'll talk next week.
Take care.
All right. Bye now. It's our buddy Bill, Mr. Stress, calling from Cleveland. Let's go to Juanita, Agnes. Hey, Juanita.
Hey, Bob. How you doing?
Good. Fine. How about you?
I'm trying to make it, Bob.
I know.
Look, I called in because the NBC and the Wall Street Journal conducted a poll about welfare in America. And the majority of Americans feel that poverty, well, wait a minute, the poll is about poverty in America. And the number one reason Americans think that there is poverty in America is welfare. Too much welfare.
Oh my God.
That's the number one reason.
So poor people being able to eat causes them to be poor.
Exactly. And look, Bob, we know that they conduct these polls to, you know, to get a certain response. And they conducted it to, you know, it was asked, the question was about people who live in the inner city. So we know what that means. You know, it's a racial issue.
Sure.
And so, you know, it speaks volumes, however, about the media. You know, the fact that our Americans are ignorant because we don't have a viable, dependable, respectable media.
No.
And, you know, this whole thing about the American family and the traditional American family is BS, Bob. I mean, the 1950s model of a family, this is the one these right-wingers love to, you know, to throw up in the 50s. That's largely shaped by Hollywood. It's a myth.
Right.
The majority of American families did not live like that. I was telling Agnes that there's a book called The Way We Never Were, and it's by a woman named Stephanie Kuntz. And in it, you know, she breaks down what the American family is, what it has been from the very beginning. And quite frankly, there's never been that so-called traditional family in America. America's families have always been step families, single heads of a family, grandparents taking care of kids. I know myself, my father left us in Beckley, left my mother and my oldest brother, and never came back. If it wasn't for my grandparents, we would have been out in the street. And my mother marries again, Bob. I don't know, maybe I think I was 6 or 7 when she married again. And the second husband did the same thing. So if it wasn't for, you know, family stepping in, you know, grandparents and extended family, you know, it would be awful. And, you know, I know I called in once before and talked about the welfare system and how it got started. And you know, it was part of the Social Security Act of 1935. And when it was enacted, it was for white single females or white widow females. Black people could not apply for welfare till 1963.
That's true.
But Stephanie Kuntz goes back, Bob, to 20 years before the revolution, the American Revolution. And she said in Concord, Massachusetts, that one-third of the kids were born out of wedlock. Now, we're talking about the Puritans.
Sure.
Yeah.
No, you don't
have to
convince me, Juanita, or anybody else here in the Horn family commune, for that matter. These are constructs that were created to keep to give and you know what, they were promulgated largely by the church,
right,
and Hollywood, and they were promulgated, right, as aspirational tools to make sure that American families always knew that they were not living up to some goal or some standard, so that they wouldn't get all uppity and think that they could get out and agitate in the streets or anything. That's what this is for. The concept of the American nuclear family, the leave it to beaver world, is actually a form of oppression.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And also she says that in 19th century America, the age of consent, now how about this for family values, was 9 or 10.
Yeah.
And let's see, from 1780 to 1790, in rural New England, one-third of the children were born out of wedlock. They conducted a study of North Carolina illegitimate births, and they found that in 1850, out-of-wedlock births were the same as in 1970. So this thing of people being, you know, monogamous and all that kind of stuff, and, you know, and back at that time, in those days, it was perfectly acceptable for men to have mistresses. And the wife...
Still is. It still is in some countries.
Well, yeah. And, it's just very, very troubling that they bring all this up. And then she says in 1890, this is probably where the movie, The Streets of, was it The Gangs of New York or something
Gangs of New York.
She said that, America had a drug problem. Then, 12-year-old prostitutes, teenage killers, kind of what we're seeing today. And so this is to me that one thing that's consistent with this nation is it never solves its social problems. Now, you can look at all the top nations, the northern European countries, Norway, Sweden, listed as the third and the fifth best countries in the world. They have high rates of out-of-wedlock births. However, they don't vilify their women for having children without husbands. And maybe it's because it's the decline of religion in those countries have made it more possible.
Well, remember, I mean, legal structures change after societies begin to change, Juanita. For instance, the idea of bastardy was a terrible problem.
Mm-hmm.
legally because of the thing, the awful things that the law did to bastards in Mariolde.
Yeah.
So, but because bastardy increased almost exponentially, the law had to take account of it. And so by the time you get over here, you begin seeing laws fairly early on saying that there would be no bastardy at law. Because this was a nation that needed warm bodies. This was a nation that needed people in the fields. This was a nation that was eager to expand. And so it goes away fairly quickly in Virginia. At West Virginia's creation in 1863, it's one of the first things that gets reaffirmed out of Virginia is that we're not going to have any bastardy.
Mm-hmm.
So, but then the social dynamic changes again in post-World War II America, and we want everybody, we're not going to have any more of that extended family stuff where you live in the same house as Granny and Grandpa and get born in the same bed that your mama got born in or anything. No. We're going to move, everybody's going to have a house, in a tract house, in a housing development. And everybody's going to have a car, and everybody's going to have 2.5 children. So you have, because we were replacing, and Joe Bagent is brilliant on this, because we were replacing one functioning family unit with an entirely new one, we had to create the memes and paradigms to support it.
Yes. Yes.
So now the culture is changing again, and the for-profit media are, of course, 900 miles behind it. And so they're still out there asking, what causes poverty, so that hopefully the white folks will say, well, feeding them brown-skinned people causes poverty. And listen, I mean, remember, the dude is in Congress now, I think. The guy, that was another weirdo right-winger from South Carolina. Their lieutenant governor at one point in time said, well, you know, my grandmama always told me if you feed them, they'll just breed.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And compared hungry human beings to cur dogs.
Yes. Yes.
You know, my parents were Depression-era children, Juanita, and they would tell me what it was like to get a mustard sandwich for lunch. And as I was growing up, I was like, ha, 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 yeah, mustard sandwich. And they'd look at me and go, no, we're not kidding. It's what we had. We would have starved without a loaf of bread and a jar of mustard.
Well, I think it's a shame, you know, that, our media, and of course, it has to do with our leadership, too, because, you know, you have to have politicians that respect the citizens. And they don't respect you if they try to appeal to the worst in you as a human being. And that is what the Republican Party and this whole right-wing apparatus has been doing for the past 30 years. And if you can blame someone else for your woes, it can be liberating, and it can also make you feel, it give you some self-esteem. It's a sad way to feel good about yourself is to look down on your fellow American citizen, but you know, this is the way the politicians have been, you know, they get away with it. And they never question about it. The Democratic Party should question the Republican Party on the tactics that they use. Though I know Clinton certainly used the welfare trope, when he was running for president. And, of course, got rid of welfare as we know it. And
I forgot to send my thank you note to Bill Clinton for that again.
Yes.
And see, there's an intersection here. This is so deeply frustrating. because there are real problems in this country that really need to be solved that have, that, as Dr. John alluded to earlier in the evening, have nothing to do with 6 foot, 6 inch tall Arabs with portable dialysis machines who hate us for our freedoms. You know, we have poverty problems in this country. We have a Senate that just cut $4 billion from the food stamp program. We have toxic problems like fracking and mountaintop removal. We've got human rights problems, among, for instance, the undocumented workforce that comes from, south of the Rio Grande. We have real massive problems in this country. We've got a youth unemployment rate that is in excess of 16%, Juanita.
I know.
And what is this government obsessed with?
Somebody getting in, I don't know what the...
The phony IRS scandal, the Benghazi, you know, that's those crazy ass Republicans.
Yes, of course.
But
of course.
Our government is legitimately concerned with reading everybody's dadgum email.
Oh, yes.
And with making sure that they know who called spankmeivebeennaughty.com at what time. Juanita, this is an indication, and I don't care, and the Republicans signed off on it, and the Democrats signed off on it, and Barack Obama executed it, and this is a sign of a government that is completely out of touch with reality.
If I can say this, Bob, I used to work for a bank. Quite a few years ago, and my job at the bank was, whenever the bank's records were subpoenaed in court, I had to go to court, and if a case went to trial, then you would testify. Also, I would get subpoenas in from various law enforcement agencies, investigating people for various crimes. Now, with the federal government, whenever their a customer's records were subpoenaed, we were supposed to notify them. That was what we were supposed to do, the bank.
Yes.
However, the FBI or the Internal Revenue, when they would come to the bank, they would simply ask, do not tell your customer that we're subpoenaing these records until 30 days. Now, the way my bank operated was, you don't tell the customer. Now, another fellow that used to work at another bank, his policy, their policy was, oh, no, we're going to tell our customers that you're after our records. So they have always had access to things that they should not have access to.
But this has been expanded in ways that we can't even begin to comprehend. And it started with George W. Bush when we started wetting our beds over the people who hated us for our freedoms. And now we've got a president who, as a campaigner, said, I disapprove of the domestic spying program, but as president, thinks it's a nifty way to keep America safe. And I'm disgusted, Juanita, aren't you?
I am disgusted, too. But check out a video it's on YouTube, by ex-CIA agent named John Stockwell. And the name of the video is The Dirty Secrets of George Bush. And I think it was made in the 80s, and it was posted on the Democratic Underground, I don't know, a few months ago. But he goes back and he talks about the beginning of the security, the sort of security apparatus of the United States. And he says it goes after the Church Committee. There were things that were going possibly be done differently. But he said once Reagan won, the FBI and the CIA were dancing in the halls because they knew they were back in business. And he goes on to say that, George W. Bush was a ex-CIA man, and by him becoming president, this was all know, it's just very, very interesting. And in fact, when you were talking about Carter, he even went back to Lyndon Baines Jones, and the Democrats have done some very, have allowed the Republicans to get away with a lot. And he said that Lyndon Baines Johnson, he appointed Earl Warren to cover up the Kennedy assassination. Earl Warren, the Republican, that was the beginning of our troubles. And then he said that when Carter did not reveal that Reagan and some operatives had went to the Iranians and told them to hold those hostages. You remember the Iranian hostage thing?
Right.
Remember when that happened? That Carter remained mum about it, even though you and I know about it, but the president himself should have came out and said that this was a terrible crime. So as we go on, whether it's Iran-Contra, where Clinton turned his back right on up to Obama turning his back on George W. Bush, it's just 60 years of unprosecuted crimes, Bob. So...
Well, and at some point it has to end, doesn't it? Or we just confess and say, you know, this is not the republic we thought it was.
But the world has people like you and Agnes, and I'm so thankful.
Well, bless your heart, Juanita. Thank you so much.
I'm so very, very thankful.
I enjoy it when I am on the road, even though I'm away from my beloved spouse. Because she sits there in the studio at the mansion and gets to have a little more interaction with folks who share their time with the program than she ordinarily does, and it is uniformly a pleasant experience on both ends. Juanita, I have to roll, but thank you very much, and yes. I wish you a wonderful weekend.
Yes, you too, Bob. You and Agnes, relax and do something wonderful.
She will, and I will. I'm in D.C. She's in West Virginia, but we'll tell each other stories. Take care, Juanita.
Bye-bye.
Bye now. Juanita calling from Ohio. It is time to get out of here, and we close the program this evening having hoped to raise $300 and having raised $20. And thank you very much, those of you who contributed that. Thank you very much. It is what keeps this all going. Back Monday. And looking forward to it. Thanks to everybody who makes all of this go. First and foremost, you with your ideas, your conversation, your emails, your tweets, your Facebooking. Thank you. Thank you very much. And thank you for your kind contributions. Thank you to our all-volunteer staff, Lottie and Sparky and Texas Betsy in the chat room. Thanks to our news ninjas, Gene and Susan. Thank you to John Fox. Thank you to Ben Birch, WhiteRoseSociety.org. Thanks to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the men and women of Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net, and yes, as discussed at the beginning of the program, acact.org. Y'all all have a wonderful weekend. Rick Smith is up next. And always, 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 Gina, Judy. It's all for you.